From San Francisco to Paris, Nashville to Amsterdam, we're reaching up.
This is John Fass in San Francisco, and we're reaching up again this week with music, some cool wisdom, and special guest Father Malcolm Boyd.
Shine your light, shine, shine your light in the darkest night. Shine your light, shine, shine your light in the darkest night. Shine your light, shine, shine your light in the darkest night. Shine your light, shine, shine your light in the darkest night. Shine your light in the darkest night, no matter what they say.
Kids are smiling, Jesus, on the tenement stoop. The little girl is the oldest, and she's apparently in charge of the younger two, her brothers. But suddenly she's crying, and her two brothers are trying to comfort her. Now everything seems to be peaceful, and she's smiling again. But what's ahead for them, Lord? Home is this broken down dump on a heartless, tough street. What kind of school will they go to? Will it be hopelessly overcrowded? Will it be a place that breeds despair? Will it change these kids' happy smiles into angry, sullen masks they'll have to wear for the rest of their lives? I look at their faces and realize how they are our victims, especially when we like to say they're beautiful children, but we don't change conditions which will make their faces hard and their hearts cynical. Have these kids got a chance, Jesus? Will they know anything about dignity or love or health? Jesus, looking at these kids, I'm afraid for them and for all of us.
Malcolm Boyd is an Episcopal priest, and he was a former Hollywood producer before he heard the call and was ordained. A poet as well, he achieved fame with a number of books, headed by his books of prayers, Are You Running With Me, Jesus?
First, I want to ask you, you had a background, I believe, in entertainment, and then you became a priest, and a hippie priest at that, at least that's the way you were known. But let's go back to the beginning. Where did your career start, and then how did you go in a spiritual direction?
After college, and incidentally, I was lost in college. I was not motivated. I barely got through it. It just wasn't a good for me. In high school, it was a disaster for me. So I was an outsider and a stranger and really a rough time. I came out to Hollywood, and somehow became motivated. Hollywood's very competitive, and I was interested. Before, I hadn't ever been very interested in life. I don't know how to put it. That's my problem and other people's too, isn't it?
Sure.
But youth was tough. But anyway, in Hollywood, you shape up or ship out, and so I shaped up and just got some great jobs producing and directing and everything, and you're swept up with some very interesting... I love creative people, and also they're very disciplined. They have to be. So Hollywood opened up another fascinating world, and I guess I rose to the top rather quickly. That's a cliche. Mary Pickford with Charlie Chaplin had more or less defined media celebrity in the 20th century and was kind of the empress of Hollywood. And we happened to meet and connected, and in my late 20s, I was her partner in a production company. So here I am, Marco Polo. And all sorts of adventures that we won't go into here. But spiritually, I was pretty dead. And, you know, searched, but I was a little like the rich young ruler in the gospel. I wasn't about to give anything up. And therefore, I couldn't have anything very much spiritually. But one night I was in a room with some very famous rich people, and I looked around, and I remember thinking, I don't want to be like this in 20 or 30 years. I want something more in my life. I mean, they had status symbols and bank accounts and all that stuff, but they weren't very happy, and they certainly made no sense to me. So the end result of that was a spiritual search and my departure from Hollywood and the industry to enter a seminary to study to be an Episcopal priest.
So, of course, what you're talking about is, I mean, here you were living the good life.
La Dolce Vita.
But there were things missing. There was happiness missing. There was fulfillment missing. And so you're talking now about the beginning of your surrender.
Identity was missing. I had no sense who I was. And if you don't know who you are, what difference does it make? And also, if you are gaining the world and losing your soul, that's certainly no not interesting to me. Yeah. So life changed from power lunches to learning how to study, which I hadn't in college, incidentally. And seminary was in Berkeley, California. Cold, rainy. Took everything I had. I remember one night I was studying late, and I think I'd gone out to get a cup of coffee or something. It was 2 a.m., it's pouring, and I hear some music, and it's familiar, and it was Ethel Merman singing "There's No Business Like Show Business," in which I no longer am, you know. But anyhow, that all worked out fine. 3 years of seminary there. And then I realized I wanted to learn more. I felt I needed to, and also maybe unlearn a little bit.
And you're talking about unlearning. What kinds of things did you want to unlearn?
I wanted to question. I'd received all this information in the seminary for 3 years, and I had some questions to ask and hadn't had a chance because I'd been on the fast track in the learning process. So anyway, I ended up then having a year in Europe, which was invaluable because all sorts of things happened to me. There was something called the house church, and there was the industrial mission, and I was able then to spend a few months in Switzerland at a institution of the World Council of Churches with some of the best and the brightest of maybe young spiritual theological people from all churches and all cultures. And boy, was that a learning experience, because I mean, there were just two Americans there, and I'd kind of thought America defined it. And here I am, my best friends are from, I think it was Brazil, Japan, South Africa. You know, it's another ballgame. So I'm completely changed by all this. I'm so grateful for that experience. And then I came back to America and did 2 more years of theology and study in New York. Randall Niebuhr was a tutor and some really wonderful people. And my first couple of books came out of that. But then one day I remember sitting around, and it was a 3-hour lunch in the seminary, and we're discussing some abstract theological issue. And I realized I needed to get out of there and get out with people.
I wanted to back up for a minute. Here you're in seminary leading a completely different kind of life. You say you learned to study, but in what other ways were you changing? Or were you being changed?
Well, before the success definition, obviously, was money and fame and that kind of thing. And that's completely changed to the concept of servanthood, of being a servant to others. And God, who had not been terribly important earlier, because there wasn't much of a concept of God, really, I'm a very strong believer in what is called the incarnation. In other words, God entering into human life for the 33 years of Jesus and living as we do. So therefore, God is accessible. God has shared everything in our life. We are loved unconditionally. I mean, this is completely radical. And a turnaround. And so my life, you know, kind of gradually changed completely as these elements got into my life and started, you know, operating.
Back with Malcolm Boyd in a few minutes on Reaching Up Radio.
Turn your ear to heaven and hear the noise inside. The sound of angels' songs, and all this for a king. We could join and sing.
this song of ice will rise. Oh, how constant, how divine, this love of ice will rise, will rise.
What's happening with children and youth all over is really tragic. No one home, low self-esteem, alcohol and drug abuse, bullying and violence, HIV infection, school after school, programs being cut, with budgets slashing, it's getting even worse. Find out how you can help. Street Cats One Heart for Kids campaign. Go to oneheartforkids.com. That's oneheartforkids.com.
This is Don Fass from San Francisco, and we're all reaching up.
Morning, Jesus. It's morning, and here's that light and sound all over again. I've got to move fast, get into the bathroom, wash up, grab a bite to eat, and run some more. I just don't feel like it, Lord. What I really want to do is get back into bed, pull up the covers, and sleep. All I seem to want today is the big sleep. And here I've got to run all over again. Where am I running? You know these things I can't understand. It's not that I need to have you tell me. What counts most is just that somebody knows. And it's you. That helps a lot. So I'll follow along, okay? But lead, Lord. Now I've got to run. Are you running with me? Jesus. It's bumper to bumper and the traffic is stalled. My radio is on. Yes, I'm listening to the news again. In a few minutes, there'll be some more music. I want to get home, Lord, but the traffic won't move. I'm tired from working, tired of waiting, tired of listening to the stupid radio. I'm too damn tired to be patient, and I'm hot and sweaty. I've worked hard all day, and I want to get home. I don't feel like being loving or patient or kind or long-suffering. Not right now. Later, maybe. If I could have anything in the world right now, it would be a road stretching out ahead, empty. All other cars gone, and a beautiful freeway for miles and miles, just for me, and then home. I just about had it today. Really, it's too much. Don't ask me to be patient. Okay, I'll try some more to be human, but it's nearly been knocked out of me for one day. Stay with me. I can't do it alone. Jesus, thanks for sweating it out with me out here on this highway.
Back with Father Malcolm Boyd.
And so then when I got out with people, that was in the form of an inner city, very poor parish in Indianapolis. There was a truck driver in the vestry. I mean, this was just a completely new ball game for me. This whole concept, and then suddenly racism is real because Well, I remember seeing a young white boy with a penknife and stabbing it in a telephone pole and just repeating, "I wish it was a nigger. I wish it was a nigger." And I'm thinking, you know, wow, what's going on here? And what's going on here is human prejudice and life. And I had to engage in it. I had to do something to change that kind of an attitude. And
Had the modern civil rights movement started at that point or not yet?
The civil rights movement was starting, and so obviously then I'm aware of it. So, but then I was given the job of a college chaplaincy in Colorado, and I went there, and then immediately ran into controversy that again changed my life very much, because coffee houses were starting up, and so we started one up at the college center, called it the Golden Grape, and just had readings and dance and music, and I mean, it was the college students and I just figuring out what prayer meant to us and God and just dealing with these realities. And there was a bishop who was sort of out of it, who didn't bother to come and look, but was offended by the image of it. And so he said to the press, denouncing the work, "You can't call yourself a beloved child of God if you have matted hair, smell badly, or wear black underwear," by which he meant leotards. So I responded in the press, "Yes, you can call yourself a beloved child of God if you have matted hair, smell badly, or wear black underwear." So we're in a civil war rather quickly here. And of course I had to go. But this defined a lot of things for me. I had taken a stand. I knew where I stood. And then I was offered another chaplaincy in Detroit at Wayne State University, an urban university in the industrial city, a very different setting. However, at that point, the call came inviting me to join a Freedom Ride in September 1961. So the civil rights movement was burgeoning here. And I remember sitting up all night in a dark room. I didn't want to go on a Freedom Ride. I was scared, terribly. But as the light kind of seeped into the room at dawn, I knew I had to. And I've always been really the cowardly lion. So I identify so much with the cowardly lion in The Wizard of Oz. In other words, I didn't have courage. So I did things that required courage without courage. But it was on-the-job training, because I acquired courage when I had to have courage and didn't have it, which is different from somebody courageous, just marching in and doing it. So I think it was 27 of us, black and white, got on the bus in New Orleans and set out across the Deep South, and a lot happened there, and arrests, et cetera, et cetera. But the next, the whole decade was really very much the civil rights movement. I remember a very frightening night in rural Tennessee, and we were like 10 of us sitting in at a restaurant that was segregated, that wouldn't serve people of color. And a lot of people are drinking and bringing across outside, and it was a very dangerous situation. Someone was killed that night. And after about a decade of just a lot of things like that, I emerged, I should say, a rather totally different person with different values. You know, it's hard. Just, I was quite a different person in a lot of ways.
While you were having the experiences that you were having in Freedom Rides and in the tumultuous time that the 60s were in America and around the world. That was also when you came to write Are You Running With Me, Jesus, and the record album with Charlie Bird. How did that all come about? In fact, how did your spiritual writing?
Well, I'd reached a point where I couldn't pray any longer to God as an elderly white male with a beard and pray in Old English. So I sort of stopped praying, because that seemed the only way to go. And then a group of Roman Catholics, a very interesting group of people, clergy and laity, invited me as their guest to go to, it was both Israel and the Vatican. And then on that trip, we ended up in the island of Cyprus for a day. And the Turks and Greeks were shooting at each other, and I mean, it was really bad. There was blood and pretty violent scene. And I remember we were in a kind of a dormitory setting one afternoon, and the others are sort of dozing, and I wrote the first prayer of Are You Running With Me, Jesus, I think on a plane ticket. In other words, I was talking to God in a different way. And God, anyway, the whole different approach to prayer, which Are You Running With Me, Jesus, represented. And so in that book, I connected with, there are a million copies in print in the U.S. and translated into most foreign languages. So a number of people and I got on the same track together with the book, and it changed. It permitted me, and I guess permitted a number of them, to pray in a different way and to look at this whole situation differently, you know?
But you call me tonight to love and responsibility. You have a job for me to do. You make me look at other persons whose needs make my self-pity a mockery and a disgrace. Lord, I hear you. I know you. I feel your presence strongly in this awful moment. And I thank you. Help me onto my feet. Help me to get up.
This is Don Fass, reaching up with you. Next week, part two of this very insightful interview with Father Malcolm Boyd. This is Don Fass. Join us next weekend and keep reaching up.